something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you'd tell me out of love that on that day I'll be okay. But we'll never know, 'cause that's not the way it works. Help me find my way. My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road. I know I'm waiting, yearning for something, something known only to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Life is one mystery. I wish that somehow you'd tell me out of love that on that day you'll forgive me. But we'll never know, 'cause that's not the way it works. I beg for your mercy. My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance. The Islamic Revolution stood up against the US. The US weren't willing to easily give up.
Therefore, the plots began. From the very beginning of the revolution, the United States began its provocations against the Iranian nation. They were against the Iranian nation. They weren't just against the Islamic Republic. They were against the Iranian nation. The U.S. started by severing relations. The severance of ties was first started by the U.S. Then it started imposing sanctions, which were followed by various other actions one after another. Truly, anyone who knows, who remembers and doesn't forget what the U.S. has done over the years, realizes the truth of Imam Khomeini's statement, "Let out all your shouts on the U.S." The U.S.'s enmity toward Iran wasn't just a verbal enmity. It wasn't just a matter of sanctions. Their enmity was shown with their actions. The U.S. conspired against the Islamic Republic as much as they could and as far as they could. They helped the inherent enemies of the Islamic Republic as much as they could, and they harmed the interests of the Iranian nation wherever they were able to inflict damage.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The arrogant nature of the U.S. wasn't compatible with the independence-seeking nature of the revolution. This is what I want to emphasize. The conflict between the Islamic Republic and the U.S. isn't a difference in tactics. It isn't an incidental disagreement. It's an inherent difference. If they have the chance, the U.S. will shoot down an Iranian passenger plane with 300 passengers to fall into the sea. If they have the chance, they will compel someone like Saddam Hussein to attack Iran and will provide him with all kinds of support. If they have the chance, they will launch a direct attack on the country. If they have the chance, they will carry out all sorts of activities using propaganda against the Islamic Republic. If they have the chance, they will do anything they can. This is the state of affairs concerning confrontation and the encounter between the Islamic Republic and the U.S. Some people distort history when writing it.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Good night to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Greetings from Tehran. Very nice to have you with us. I invite you to listen to some interesting facts about Islam. Islam does not have an ordained clergy or representatives of a church hierarchy in the way that Christianity does. However, every mosque has an imam, or the one who stands in front to prayer and deliver the sermon. Jesus is an important figure in the Holy Quran. Like Christians, Muslims believe in the virginal conception of Jesus by God's Spirit. However, Muslims do not believe Jesus is the Son of God. For Muslims, the concept of the Holy Trinity represents a form of polytheism. And the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them all, along with a brief explanation about the hadith. After that, we have Spotlight, a program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have Viewpoints. The program presents an analytical roundtable discussion of various political and social issues of the Islamic world today. And our final program this hour is our varied radio productions feature.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear listeners, peace and blessings be upon you all. Salam. And welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Today, we reflect on a striking warning from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his holy progeny. And before I say it, you know, prevention is always better than healing, curing the disease after it happens. So he is quoted to have said, "Beware of greed, beware of greed, for it destroyed those before you." It commanded them to be stingy, so they were stingy. It commanded them to sever ties, so they cut off one another. And it commanded them to sin, so they sinned. So this hadith highlights how a single inner disease, like greed, can poison families, communities, and entire civilizations. Shuh. In other words, in Arabic, shuh or greed is more than just being careful with money. It is a deep selfishness, an unwillingness to share, to give, or to care. It's the voice inside that says, me first, always. Modern psychology has shown that chronic greed is linked to higher anxiety and lower happiness. A 2017 study in the Journal of Personality found that people with high materialistic values often experience more loneliness and less life satisfaction. So greed doesn't just harm others, it eats the greedy person from within. History also testifies to this truth. Many nations collapsed because of greed. Even in our time, financial crises are often triggered by unchecked greed. The 2008 global financial meltdown, for example, was fueled by a reckless pursuit of profit without responsibility. What the Prophet warned centuries ago is still painfully real today. So the Prophet explained that greed doesn't stop at stinginess. It spreads like a chain reaction. First, it makes people miserly, withholding wealth, knowledge, or even kindness. Then it breaks relationships because selfishness erodes trust and cooperation. Families fight over inheritance, communities spill it over resources, and finally, it pushes into immorality. When the only goal is personal gain, people justify lying, cheating, and even betrayal. So greed starts in the heart, but ends in social collapse. That's kind of wonderful in the negative way. So what's the remedy? The prophet's life gives us the answer, generosity. Even a small acts matter. A smile, a kind word, sharing time. Neuroscience research shows that generosity activates the brain's reward system, giving us a helper's high. And strengthen family ties, sets values above wealth, and remember accountability, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Allah 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 Allah
ya Rabbi
Allah Allah
ya Rabbi
Allah Allah Allah
of those in the night they will stand and cry in hope and in fear. Nothing in the world can ever turn their hearts away from the calm of surrender they find when they say,
Bring us on from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Israeli genocide on Gaza continues, along with its frequent attacks on Lebanon, killing more civilians. Meanwhile, the U.S. government has released a document regarding its national security strategy. It says that conflict and violence in the Middle East are subsiding since the ceasefire in Gaza and the U.S.'s attack on Iran. Now, the Trump administration says it will now concentrate on the Western Hemisphere and regional dominance. This is Trump says the U.S. will re-implement the Monroe Doctrine. Well, what is going on in Trumpville, and where is it all headed, and what does it mean for Latin America and beyond? Stay with us as we take a look at the latest on the Spotlight. Let's begin with this report.
The Trump administration has released its National Security Strategy for 2025, a document that marks stark differences from earlier strategies issued by the same administration. Let's go over some of the key details.
Western hemispheric dominance, aiming to block what it calls foreign influence in the Americas and shift U.S. military assets toward the Western Hemisphere, away from theaters whose relative importance to American national security has declined in recent decades.
The strategy outlines a major shift in U.S. military posture. Observers say the move may be linked to recent U.S. strikes on boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific, and efforts to remove Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro by force.
Deterring conflict over Taiwan, unlike earlier strategies that framed China as the top geopolitical rival, the 2025 NSS declares that economic relations are the decisive arena. It underscores the need for allies, particularly India, to increase defense spending to help balance China's growing power in the Indo-Pacific.
The document signals a change in tone. Rather than framing China solely as a geopolitical rival, it emphasizes economic competition as the decisive arena. At the same time, it calls on allies, particularly India, to increase defense spending to help balance China's growing influence in the Indo-Pacific.
Berating Europe, criticizing Europe's migration policies, regulatory focus, and handling of Ukraine conflict, suggesting that the continent must take primary responsibility for its own defense. Switching focus from the West Asia, declaring the region no longer a top priority due to U.S. energy independence and perceived decline in conflict, though still committed to Israel's security. It goes on to argue that the conflict and violence in the region are also subsiding, citing the ceasefire in Gaza and the U.S. attack on Iran in June, which it said significantly degraded Tehran's nuclear program.
It declares the United States energy independent, a claim critics say underscores whether Washington's past involvement in the region was driven by oil. Yet critics point out that Israeli violations of the Gaza ceasefire continue, and Iran remains determined to pursue its peaceful nuclear program. Upon a question about Gaza ceasefire's phase two, Trump told reporters on Thursday that it was going along well. He acknowledged Palestinian deaths as a problem, yet he insisted that West Asia is at peace.
We have peace in the Middle East. People don't realize it. We have tremendous support. 59 countries. There's tremendous support.
Tehran has dismissed the strategy as essentially a security document for Israel. Iran argues that ensuring U.S. access to regional energy resources and guaranteeing Israel's security are the two fundamental issues driving Washington's policy in West Asia. Critics say the new national security strategy only underscores the hypocrisy of the Trump administration, revealing that America's true aim has always been dominating global energy and expanding Israel's power at any cost.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Joe Immisberger, writer and political commentator out of Windsor, Canada. And and Mike Billington, author and commentator out of Leesburg, out of the U.S. Thank you both for being with me to start this off in Canada. And Joe, well, let's look at some of the issues highlighted in this document. But first, let me ask you, why now? Why is the U.S. saying that the Western Hemisphere will be its priority and the Middle East or West Asia is actually calming?
Well, it's obviously untrue that it's calming. I mean, the genocide in Gaza continues, and the United States has already forced through a resolution, the UN resolution, making itself the colonial governor of Gaza, of the Palestinian territories, on behalf of Israel. So it's patently untrue that anything's calming. It's just as long as Palestinians are dying at a level that isn't gaining too much attention in media, and as long as Israelis are not dying at a rate that's noticeable in the media, then they consider it to be a calm. So it's obviously untrue. When you look at documents like this, there's obviously a tremendous amount of dishonesty in them, so you always have to distinguish between what's real and what's... but the document, to me, I read through it, and it's the typical U.S. Declaration that it rules, that it's the dictator of the entire Western Hemisphere, and that it's going to be determined to be the dictator, basically. So I think some of this shift from West Asia stuff is just appealing to its base that's sick of the so-called forever wars. I mean, they even use that term forever wars in the document. So there's this need to kind of package their foreign policy to their base as something different that's not going to entangle the United States in wars. But when you're seeking to be the world's supremacist state that tells everybody what to do, including your so-called allies in Europe, then of course you're going to a war.
Okay. Well, Mike, I mean, the document says its goal is America first. Of course, that was Trump's main thing running for presidency. I mean, with that in mind, why do we not see a change in Washington's support for the Israeli regime, even with this new document?
Well, with the Israeli machine, the so-called Zionist lobby, this is a deeply ingrained force within the United States. And Trump does respond to that force. He's part of it, in a sense. So that's not surprising. I would emphasize, however, that the big problem, let me say two things. One is that there are very good aspects to this document. Let me come back to that. The biggest problem with it is this idea that we can take over the Western Hemisphere, and this, of course, is at a moment where the Trump administration, under people like Marco Rubio, we call him Narco Rubio, and Hegseth, are planning to unleash a new war, exactly what Trump swore he would not do during his election campaign and since. But they're about to start a war that would not only be Venezuela, but probably all of Ibero-America. And the real intent here has absolutely nothing to do with drugs, which they claim this is stopping drug trade. But in fact, Venezuela's drug trade is minimal compared to Colombia and other places. But the purpose is to prevent especially China, but also Russia, from having any role whatsoever in South America. This is what terrifies the financial institutions in London and Washington and New York, which is that the ability to control and loot the raw materials in places like South America, but also Africa and elsewhere, because they're turning to the Belt and Road and to the Chinese for real development rather than just financing and then looting. But let me say that there are very, very positive aspects, and you asked what? Well, I'm going to read you a quote from a former CIA analyst, Larry Johnson, who has become a leading spokesman against the war policy in the U.S. By both the Biden and earlier administrations, and unfortunately, as Trump is not completely separate from, despite his very honorable effort to reestablish relations with Russia, and the work that took place over these last week or so with Wycliffe on his talks with Putin and Ushakov represent a very positive and potentially resolutionary state of this. And let me read what Larry Johnson said, because he also makes the same mistake on the question of South America, but he says otherwise that this document, marks a potentially profound shift in U.S. foreign policy under President Donald Reagan's second administration, rejecting global hegemony and ideological crusades in favor of pragmatic, transactional realism focused on protecting poor national interests, homeland security, and economic prosperity, and regional dominance of the Western Hemisphere. So he capitulates on this so-called dominance of the Western Hemisphere, which, of course, with Rubio and the Trump administration criminally bombing boats for which they have no evidence there's any crimes being carried out. They just claim these are drug boats, but even if they are, they're not in a position to reach the United States. It's a fake. It's like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's a fake excuse for a policy which is very, very dangerous.
Okay, stay with me. Sorry to interrupt you, Mike, but let me get Joe back in on this conversation. I mean, Joe, you heard what Mike had said about the positive side of this. On the one hand, though, Mike said that, unfortunately, what they're looking at in Latin America and now what they're doing to the fishermen or whatever, this isn't new, though, the policy of the United States. As he also was talking about the WMDs in Iraq, there's always been some type of excuse. But what it seems this document basically also is saying, that they're not going to even use the spread of democracy excuse anymore. Because in the document, basically, it's saying that, you know what, people have different ways of running their systems, and basically we're not even worried about that anymore. So there is definitely fundamental change in what is happening. What do you attribute this to, Joe?
Well, the United States has been in relative decline ever since the end of World War II. So to some extent, they have to acknowledge reality. For example, the last, Trump's segment of the Republican Party, sure, they're less hawkish towards Russia because they aren't comfortable with the idea of taking on Russia and China at the same time. That's actually stupid from an imperial point of view. So they can look somewhat more rational in a way when they talk about Russia than the Democrats, who are just gung ho about confronting Russia and China at the same time. So there's kind of an acknowledgement of reality that you're in relative decline and that you have to pick your fights and prioritize. But that's always the case with an empire. But the problem is that when you're an empire, when you're seeking the kind of even regional dominance that they claim they're seeking, it's a global dominance that they're after. But to even do that, they cannot never let any piece of it break away. I mean, that's why Trump's blatantly interfering in the election in Honduras. I mean, these Honduras, unlike Venezuela, doesn't claim to have the world's largest oil reserves or anything, but they can't help but interfere in small countries like Cuba, like even Haiti. They can't let any little piece of the world get away without them being involved and trying to steer it in their direction and undermine its sovereignty. So it's, I think, regardless of even if they sincerely wanted to try to pick their battles, but when you're aspiring to be to dominate the world, then you're going to end up getting intervening everywhere because you just can't afford to let anything slip out of your grasp. So I think this is just a difference in the way that different factions of the U.S. ruling elite, the way they market themselves. Trump doesn't want to, his base doesn't like things like, you know, democracy and pretending that they're going to overthrow Maduro out of some benevolent or altruistic desire to free Venezuelans. They prefer to concoct an excuse that we're defending ourselves. So it's a difference in marketing, but the overall global imperial strategy is the same.
All right. Well, Mike, now the U.S. claims that the situation is calming in the Middle East or Western Asia, but in reality, with Washington's continued support of the Zionist regime, the genocide has not ended in Gaza, and the regime continues to kill people in the West Bank and in Lebanon. The U.S. lights the flame and then says it has stepped out of the fire. I mean, what are your thoughts overall about this? Is this just the U.S. knowing that it has failed in West Asia and is trying to find an escape, or how do you see it?
I think both what you and your friend from Canada said is giving into an extremely simplistic view of the world situation as a whole right now. And I don't disagree with what you're saying and what both of you are saying about what's happening in the Middle East and in South America. But the crucial thing taking place in the world right now is that the potential of a global nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia, or Russia and China, is being given an alternative approach by what Trump is doing in the total opposite approach of what we've had in previous governments, to try to bring about some cooperation with Russia, and the Russians are very open to this. And he's now going to go meet with Xi Jinping in China. So the potential of having a similar positive relationship with China is also on the table. And nothing can be more important in a world facing economic disintegration and the potential of nuclear war than these three major powers coming together. If we can bring about a sane approach in the U.S. to working with the BRICS countries, working with Russia and with China and the other global South countries, this would be a potential dramatic shift in history. The ending of the colonial era and the unleashing of what could and must be what the LaRouche movement has always fought for, a new architecture based on security and development for every country on Earth. Now, obviously, that doesn't cohere with launching a new insane war in South America, or the continuation of the battle in Gaza and in the Palestinian area.
Okay, let me just jump in here, because isn't that where the problem lies? Understand what you're saying, Mike, as far as perhaps intention in some cases with the U.S. government. But Joe, when we look at the reality that's happening, at the end of the day, the United States is basically the military-industrial complex runs the show, and are they ready to actually give up this hegemonic perspective in creating chaos in order to work together? Yes, we all know that it's better to work together, but that has never been the intent of imperialist entities. I mean, how do you see it?
Well, first of all, the domination of the Western Hemisphere, that makes sense. If you want to confront China and Russia down the road more effectively, you want to secure greater control of the countries closer to you. So what I see this is to some extent some maneuvering to maybe try to get Russia and China basically to sell out South America, Central and South America, and just say, okay, this is our turf. We'll stay out of it, and we'll give you some concessions on other things. So I see that. I see that ultimately is a very sinister maneuver that I don't think is going to prevent the United States from confronting Russia and China, because the very nature of the United States, and you can see it all over this document, is to become the global, become what even more of what it already is, a global empire, a bully that just tells everybody else, including even the Europeans. I mean, it's actually kind of comical in portions of this document where they're demanding, basically shaking down the Europeans for more, and the Canadians for increased military spending. That means, you know, increased money for the U.S. Contractors and stuff. It's just a shakedown. So I think that's in the nature of what the imperial power is. And I think this shift towards the Western Hemisphere is just. It's just going to, if anything, just bring up, it's just them positioning for themselves for confrontation, more direct confrontation with China and Russia down the road.
Hmm. Well, Mike, what does it mean in your perspective when Washington says it basically wants to reenact the Monroe Doctrine? First of all, what does it mean for Latin America itself? And also, what does it mean for the Europeans? Because there seems to be a definitely clash there. From the perspective of the Trump administration towards the Europeans?
Well, the Europeans are totally freaked out by this national security strategy, precisely because of what I said before, which is that this strategy very explicitly says Europe is destroying itself, he doesn't use the word insane, but he's actually demonstrating a insanity in the leadership of the so-called coalition of the willing in Europe, who are hell-bent on continuing the war with Russia. And they even stupidly claim that they could fight the war themselves without the U.S. military backing, and could, in fact, start a war with Russia, which would be lead rapidly to global nuclear war, and is a level of insanity which has to be identified. So that's the Europeans. In terms of the Monroe Doctrine, I think it's very important to acknowledge that the original Monroe Doctrine was an anti-colonial, anti-imperial policy. It was not to justify U.S. colonial policy in South America. It was to prevent the then colonial powers in Europe from coming into South America. That, unfortunately, was reversed by what was called the Roosevelt Corollary, referring to Teddy Roosevelt, not FDR, who basically said that, in fact, the U.S. will be militarily involved in South America, and subsequently, as we know, they were. But the original was not that intention. The founding fathers of the United States were not only committed to developing America as a strong industrial democratic power, but were absolutely committed to ending colonial power globally. And they were not able to do that because of changes that took place in the United States and then the ultimate emergence of outright fascism in places in Europe and in Asia. So this is a crisis, but the reality of what's taking place with this national security strategy is hopefully, and this is the way our organization and our associates should be treating this. We can act to prevent the insanity of a new war in South America. We can stop that. It hasn't happened yet. And we can do that by emphasizing the tremendous positive potential of a U.S.-Russia-Chinese cooperation around development. What should they cooperate on? They should cooperate on developing the Arctic, on developing Africa, on developing Ibero-America. Look what's happened in South America so far. China built the biggest port on the entire Pacific coast, the Chancay port in Peru, and they're talking to Brazil and others about building a bioceanic railroad between the Pacific and the Atlantic, from the Chancay port in Peru up to the Atlantic coast in Brazil. Now, these are the kind of policies that the U.S., with sane leadership, would jump at. It would be tremendous to rebuild the U.S. industrial infrastructure, which is in a state of collapse, not quite as bad as that of Europe, but it's heading in that direction with a financial bubble, with the IT bubble, and with the cryptocurrency bubbles, which are now ready to blow apart, bringing about a bigger crisis than the 2008 breakdown. Okay. So, you know, these are issues that should be on our table rather than trying to further exemplify that the U.S. cannot be changed and that it's going to go into another round of wars.
What about that, Joe? I mean, I think probably all of us would agree here that that should be on the agenda of the United States, countries working together. I mean, it really works. But that has not been what we have seen from the United States. And now Trump is criticizing, actually, the Europeans and even their crackdown on free speech and political opposition, while at the same time there is crackdown on free speech inside of the United States. So there just seems to be a lot of contradictions in general. I mean, your take on that part of it.
Yeah, well, when people like Trump talk about free speech, they talk about freedom for Nazis to incite violence against minorities. That's what matters to them. They want you to be able to go out on cameras and say that the immigrants are destroying our country, basically to incite violence against ethnic minorities. They're not going to stick up for the Palestine Action for example. People are getting arrested in the UK and being called terrorists because they're opposed to genocide in Gaza. They're never going to stick up for that. That's not free speech that they care give a damn about. They just care about the fascists being able to incite against ethnic minorities. So that's all this nonsense about free speech that he mentions in the document. And yeah, I noticed that. The United States, from its founding fathers, has been a genocidal state. I mean, its foundation was based on genociding. It's right in the Declaration of Independence. that the foreign powers were inciting the original inhabitants, the natives of the United States, against them. So it's always been genocidal from day one. I reject this idea that the founding fathers were some noble figures. I mean, that's just a complete reversal of the truth. So in terms of United States trying to get China and Russia to cooperate, I think this is something dangerous because we've already seen what kind of cooperation they could get. For example, the China and Russia both abstained on what was basically a genocidal resolution that allowed the United States and Israel to become the with the UN endorsement, become the colonial rulers of Gaza. I mean, and that's just outrageous. So that's the kind of the rest of the world should be opposed to that. If they're going to be cooperating with the United States to help them suppress countries all over the world, then that's something we should
do. All right, let me give Mike 30 seconds. Mike, go ahead. Last comments.
Well, again, you know, these simplistic views which try to create a single view of the direction of what's taking place, rather than thinking like a creative human being about what should we push forward as the necessary positive solution. And again, I mean, we have the potential for a U.S.-Russia-China cooperation, joining the BRICS. Why not have everyone recognize that this is a real potential and that Trump and some of the better people around him, rather than the Rubios and the Hegseths, recognize that.
I'm out of time. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Appreciate both of you being with me, Joe Imsberger out of Canada, Mike Billington out of the U.S. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Liaqat and Sheikh Latifi. Sheikh Liaqat, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Latifi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam to you and to your dear listeners.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of spirituality and religion, the difference between the two, and which one is more comprehensive. Sometimes some people might claim that, okay, you can reach a spiritual development without religious. Out of the religious laws, you can also, spiritually speaking, be developed. The status of human being in here is really important. So how do you look a human in both the spiritual movements and now the monotheistic religions, Sheikh? I mean, this is really important because if you look at the human being as the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is over here, on that time, religious teachings are all, we can say, led towards such a purpose. In comparison, or in contrast, it's better to say, with the spiritual movements, which I think that most of their goals are materialistic, these worldly goals, rather than the otherworldly one.
Yeah, there are two aspects of discussion. One is the appearance of it, and like I would say, the most apparent part of it that are, for example, as you said, the ecstasy thing or the building of character. And I do not agree that all people who claim to have religious, faithless spirituality, they are having better akhlaq. Mm-hmm. Some of these people, they get on business class plane coming from some, I mean, Western countries to India. They spend some time, they discharge themselves emotionally, they went back, they go back to their own companies, their businesses, and they act like monster with the people over there. So, so it, if you haven't seen it, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Okay. It is there. So this is two separate things completely. A devotion to a cause and actually living up to it, it's different. When it comes to the core of, this is the building character and ecstasy, all the appearances.
Yes.
But when we go to the core of the issue, and we have on one side, we have faithless spirituality, and then we have religions.
Mm-hmm.
What comes to my eyes, the first glance, is the crisis of the meaning of life.
Mm-hmm.
That is the core of the concept, the question of spirituality. What is the meaning of my life?
That's right.
And if, as long as the meaning of my life is something that I create for myself, it's not a meaning. It's not meaningful.
All right.
So the problem with these self-made spiritualities is that these are, as Quran puts it, asma'un sammaytumuha antum wa abakum. These are certain concepts you have created for yourselves.
All right.
And the miraculous nature of human soul is that you create something, and you know you have created it, but it starts to affect you.
Okay.
So we don't deny that it doesn't have effect on people. It has effect.
And psychologically, it has its own effects.
Yeah.
You know, it could have positive effects too, like anger management classes.
Yes, yes. It has some short-term effects. Like, for example, you are consumed by the ideas that you have created for yourself.
Uh-huh.
But it does not answer the question of the meaning of life. At the end of the day, if you're honest with yourself, you realize that it doesn't have any basis in truth. It is something that some guy has created somewhere. And how does it link me to the eternality? How does it? But when we come to religion, the meaning of life or the concept of haq, that Quran, we recite in the Holy Quran, خَلَقْنَا السَّمَاءَ وَالْأَرْضَ بِالْحَقِّ for several times.
Yes.
That there is some sort of wisdom behind this. Or, for example, those verses that says, people look at, there are servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that would look at the universe, the earth, the heavens, and say, رَبَّنَا مَا خَلَقْتَ هَذَا بَاطِلًا.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for a false cause. There's a reason that we are here and that I am here. So the sense of meaning that I get from religion is completely different from the kind of meaning of life that I get from these faithless spiritualities.
Yes.
It's very serious.
Mm-hmm.
The level of accountability, responsibility that I had towards a personal God, not some sort of cosmic energy.
Yes.
No, it is a personal God that I can connect to, that I can talk to, that I can pray to. This is different. So when it comes to the advantages and disadvantages, there, in Islam, do you want meditation? The best kind of meditation is mindful prayer. Hudur al-qalb fi salat. If you want to practice meditation, this is good for you.
Okay.
Go and do it. Like midnight prayer with Hudur al-qalb, best kind of meditation. Meditation through the verses of the Holy Quran. Meditations through the supplication to Allah.
They very much emphasize on faith without commitment. I mean,
is something you can play with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the faith without commitment is that, okay, it's voluntary, whatever, whenever you want, you like to do that. Okay, it's morning salat. No problem. Let's shift it to day, for example. I don't know, noon, night, or something like that. And then, okay. And since human beings are neglectful, okay, so
they like that version.
Like that version, but they don't know that the models, even that are talking about, for example, spiritual developments, they have their own certain timings. They have their own
discipline. I wanted to talk about discipline as well.
Yes. Okay.
The discipline that you have in a spiritual, like faithless spiritualities, again, because still there are rooms for you to change it.
But
the kind of discipline, because why do you need discipline? You need, for building character, you need discipline and you need determination. And you cannot build up determination without discipline. You have to Invest on Some Minor Changes. There's this really good book, Atomic Habits. Okay. I don't know if you have read it. Mm-hmm. So it tells you if you want to change yourself, you have to start to change from a smaller stuff, not biggest stuff.
Yes.
So in Islam, we have this. Like it tells you, start prayer daily on time, for example. And then if you want to add something up on that, you can add.
Yes.
It gives you a sense of discipline that is gradual, that is real, and that has some sense in it. It's not something that I have set for myself. This is something I have the faith and belief that it has been set by someone who has created me and knows everything about my spirit.
That's why whenever you go to the most famous Muslim Shiites or Arafah or mystics, you know, whenever you ask, what's the key to your success is Salah. Mm. Okay? So nothing out of salat, nothing out of Sharia law can help you in this regard.
You should work on the quality of the
quality,
salat.
Quality exactly. of the salat. Yep. That's right. Okay. Sheikh Le'Agha, let's go on. What's your comment on that?
I think you have like
a lot to say.
Just like the Sheikh has said, I would point out to the way Islam was revealed over here. In those days when Islam was revealed, everything was not revealed in one day, all at once. So just like Sheikh has pointed towards atomic habits, I would say, example, if we want to start spirituality from the basic example, like, of course, reciting it on time, like, of course, awwal al-waqt example, in the beginning of the time itself and not delaying it, even if we have a lot of time to recite, example, Salat al-Zuhr and Asr example, but still reciting it in the first go itself and concentrating on how we are performing wudu, example. One of the scholars was saying, wudu has nur in it, of course, from a hadith he was pointing out towards the hadith. And if we perform wudu in the way it should be performed, like with all the huzur al-qalb example, then we will have that light upon us. And it will consume, the light will be consumed inside us, and we would emit light, the light of wudu, of course. So this is the basic spirituality. So spirituality is there in every single part of the religion of Islam. And when the Prophet brought the religion in into the life of the people of that era, he didn't say all at once, okay, today you have to do wudu with all the spirituality in it, like have huzur al-qalb. Now you are reciting namaz, have huzur al-qalb in when you're reciting your example surah, when you're in ruku, do it like this. No, it was not the case. Example, alcohol was abandoned, or it was a term that it is not legal Islamically. That's right. In the later stages, it was not on day one when Islam came.
It was a gradual process.
So what I would say is, if there are people who are not attaining spirituality through the religion of Islam, there's of course there's mistake somewhere or the other in their life which they're not trying hard upon, and they have to start from the beginning or from small things and try to work on them consistently. Like it should be there should be discipline in it, there should be consistency in it, otherwise
Sheikh,
they wouldn't
be successful. What do you mean by the fact that they do not find a spirituality? Do you mean about that they don't find a hall, or their character is miserable?
The character, what I mean is the character. What I mean is, if we look at the Holy Quran, tanha anil fahsha in as-salat, example. So salat in itself, tanha anil fahsha wal munkar, it would bring a person away from fahsha and munkar, that which is not liked by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is the spirituality of salat.
The core
of salat, I would say, one of the core reasons why salat is there in a person's life, and the connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, would remove a person from that which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't like.
Our dear listeners can go and Google the salat done by Ayatollah Bahjat when leading the prayer, okay? You know, you can and compare it with yourself, please, okay? The quality of his salat is